We ended the last class with, I think it was Rocky asked the question about the Millennial Harbinger, this periodical that Campbell put out, and so that caused me to go back and do a little bit of research. As it turns out, Campbell and really the vast majority of those men who were involved in this movement back in the 1800s were post-millennialists. And I'll read you a couple of things, but basically their view, they didn't think of the millennial period as Christ coming during that thousand-year reign. They expected Christ to come after that thousand-year reign. And I'll read a couple of things here to give you an idea what the thousand-year reign was in their view. He had a what was called a prospectus of his Millennial Harbinger in the first volume. He says, "This work shall be devoted to the destruction of sectarianism, infidelity, and anti-Christian doctrine and practice. It shall have for its objective the development and introduction of that political and religious order of society called the Millennium, which will be the consummation of that ultimate amelioration of society proposed in the Christian scriptures." Here's another writing he put out in the same general time frame. "The millennium will be a state of greatly enlarged and continuous prosperity in which the Lord will be exalted and his divine spirit enjoyed in an unprecedented measure. All the conditions of society will be vastly improved. War shall cease, and peace and goodwill among men will generally abound. Genuine Christianity will be diffused through all nations. Crimes and punishments will cease. Governments will recognize human rights and will rest on just and benevolent principles." Basically, these men saw the millennium as the fulfillment of the efforts they were making in this restoration to go back to the Bible, to establish a faith and a practice that followed the Bible, and spread that over time through the population, which in turn would bring about adherence to all these principles of God and bring peace on earth for 1,000 years. And that was their objective, one of them. And so you'll see in the writings of not just Campbell, but Scott and others, as they had these magazines, that the vast majority of them held this same general view. And then after this period of time, Christ would come back, not to live on the earth, but the second coming, and to take, put the resurrection, and those on the earth to go back with him, those who are faithful. So that's where that came, and yes, and where they were, and yes, Millennial Harbinger is a direct, or is related to that directly, from his standpoint. It's a good question, appreciate it. Maybe go back and do a little looking. In the course of that, I just want to bring up one other thing to you. And this may be a pet peeve of mine, I don't know. But I ran across this is the Gravel Hill Church of Christ. It's in Arkansas. And they have a page on their website. And it's called the Brotherhood Publications. Now, I'm just going to, here's my pet peeve, and I think scripturally I think I can stand behind this. People, you'll hear people, or I have heard people, speak of the brotherhood as if it's some corporate body, please, as opposed to simply the way the Bible uses it, which is referring just to brethren, believers in Christ. But people will start talking about the brotherhood this and the brotherhood that, as if this is a group working in concert with one another. And that's kind of what happens here. These are brotherhood publications. And so these are things that have to do with issues important to the brotherhood. And they list think I had about 5 pages of publications. And I just want to give you an idea. Some of these you may have heard about. The Abundant Life is put out by the Westside Church of Christ in Irving. Some of these, by the way, are just periodicals. I mean, not periodicals, but bulletin kind of affairs. Another one is Basic Christianity. This is one put out by the Non-Sunday School Congregation in Fayetteville. They listed another one, Christian Expositor Journal. It's put out by the One Cup Non-Sunday School Brethren. The Gospel Advocate, we talked about briefly. The Light is a One Cup, what they call a One Cup publication. OPAS Advocate is a non-institutional publication, parentheses, One Cup, non-Sunday school. And they want to say, still apparently influential in that section of the Brotherhood. So anyway, this is just, you can, they list ones that, and the reason I went there, they listed all these publications, some of them active, some of them out of business. I was just curious what was no longer being published in some of these things that we've run across, where it wasn't obvious that they'd stopped, or I didn't have to say it, they'd stopped. So I just want to bring that to your attention. Just be aware, just like, and we'll talk, if we get there, probably won't get there today, but you run the risk, let me rephrase that. Our language sometimes will reflect our thinking, and there may be absolutely nothing wrong with using the term brotherhood. You know, I'll tell you, it's my pet peeve. Just, it depends on your context. So just be careful of these kinds of terms. You don't fall into the trap that it lays there and can catch you.
Did that site mention the Herald of Truth?
I don't recall seeing that one on there. No. Okay. Which is a radio program, primarily.
Well, there was some articles and everything put out.
Their main issue, the Herald of Truth, their main issue was, and there are plenty of articles written about the Herald of Truth. Herald of Truth, was their main issue, if memory serves me, was to have, they were a sponsoring church for people to send funds to so they could preach the gospel over the airwaves. Under the sponsorship or under the leadership, oversight of the elders at that church, which escapes me right now, I think it's in Abilene. Okay. So that's a little side trip. We've been looking at trying to keep it fairly brief. And men who were contemporaries of Stone and Campbell in that period of time are near contemporaries that were influential in their geographical area in the so-called Restoration movement. Of course, we talked about Scott, Smith, Fanning, men we've been looking at kind of a little bit of their history and where they tended to be active and issues they were either for or against. Today, I wanted to get into Benjamin Franklin. This is not Ben Franklin of the Declaration of Independence. However, he is related. This Benjamin Franklin is a great nephew of the one we're familiar with, who was involved with the Declaration of Independence. Josiah was his father. That Benjamin's father had 17 children, and as time, and you're going to see this. These folks took literally the idea, be fruitful and multiply. They had people. They had kids during this time period. So anyway, one of Josiah's sons was Benjamin Franklin, sire of independence. But to trace the line from his brother down to this lineage, and you run into Joseph. And Franklin, who married Isabella, as I noted in your lesson. When Joseph moved to Indiana, he came across a guy by the name of Rogers, Samuel Rogers, and they agreed to sit down, and every Saturday they'd sit down and study the Bible. And they agreed ahead of time they would not have any follow-on on issues they disagree with each other on. They just mark it and go on. And when they got through going all through the Bible, they'd come back and address those issues. Well, it turns out they didn't have any issues to address. It turned out that they agreed on everything. So subsequent to that, there were studies that would happen, and the result of that was Joseph was baptized. And then shortly after that, Benjamin, the Benjamin we're talking about, and his brother were baptized, converted. And then the wife of Benjamin was converted. And then not too long after that, this grew into 40 or 50 people that had been converted to Christ based on this product of this study between these two men. Ben himself, you'll see in your notes, I think this is in your notes, that Ben was sort of brought up in the backwoods. We don't think of Indiana's backwoods, but that's what it was then. And didn't have a lot of education, like the education as we think of it. Had poor grammar. But over time, he would improve. And in fact, it said of him that he was one of the most powerful presenters in this time frame. And a number of these men apparently were pretty impressive speakers and could command the attention of an audience, because we've seen this, depending on who the autobiographer is, you get this kind of view, and that depends on their research, of course, who was talking about these men. But what would happen is he ended up, he could stand up and preach for a couple hours without notes, and he quoted scripture, just volumes of scripture. And so he was intended on being a pure gospel preacher, not a philosopher, not a politician or teller of stories. He just went straight to the heart of the matter in terms of how he preached. He would start, like these men, we've seen with these men, a journal with time. In his case, it was called the Reformer, and that would evolve into or be joined with this other published item called the Western Reformer, or it became the Western Reformer. He changed it over in name, and it would be merged then ultimately with the Gospel Proclamation. And part of this is because he got merged, in part because he couldn't make a go of it financially with his own magazine. He had a number of discussions. These men were, in fact, this Benjamin was well known for his ability to debate. And he had some debates with a couple of Universalist preachers that he took on, and also another fellow was a Methodist preacher that he debated, and there were probably others I'm not aware of. He would, as I mentioned, he would have these various mergers of his paper, but his paper didn't make it even after the merger, so he ended up going to be a co-editor on the Christian page. And there's a fellow by the name of D.S. Burnett that was the other writer. And the result of this grouping, if you please, was reasonably successful, but he was still, during this time, he just mainly spent his time preaching and worked with a church in Cincinnati and also a church in Kentucky as well. Then he went to publish in the American Christian Review, and in that he had some other men he was involved with, a fellow by the name of Moses Lard. I'll flip between Laird and Lard. I guess it's the way it's spelled, it's Lard. A fellow by the name of Luce, John Rogers, Isaac Arrett, who we'll talk about later. We'll talk about Lard and Arrett later in this lesson. And this review, for a lot of years, was viewed as the most influential paper in the quote brotherhood. So here's that other concept. And so what evolves, what will be happening, and again, I'm tell you about my view of brotherhood. What would happen is you have, as the sides begin to be taken, you're going to have this brotherhood paper that would be arguing issues against that brotherhood paper. Okay, and we'll maybe see that as we get in later lessons. So this was a paper that this time was very influential in a brotherhood that was dealing with some issues, foremost among them, the Missionary Society and instrumental music.
Okay.
Yes.
Because this Missionary Society definition changes, can you define at this time what that meant? Was that just preaching? Like, sent churches sending money to a group just for...
Yeah, we will talk, I think it's in less than 20, whatever it is, 23, did we hit 23? I think we did. 23 or 24. We'll talk specifically about some of these societies and how they came into being. And this was mainly a cooperative where it was churches would get together, send money, and the society itself would be the focal point of that to send preachers out to various places.
And the reason I ask is sometimes it's a fine line. You know, it's like how you organize it, basically, where it's one of those matters where people can start diverting off of the New Testament pattern, where, you know, there were churches that supported preachers, and preachers went off and didn't work, and we support preachers in other locations. And it doesn't matter if they stay in one location or they...
No, that's, yeah. That's not a society that's in view
right.
here. This is a cooperative society. Okay. It's its own organization. It has its own, you know, its own leadership. It makes its own decisions, and they were responsible for. And, you know, these groups, this group looked at itself as fulfilling the Great Commission. I thought that was their role. Okay. And the thing was, this particular one, we'll see as we talk about it in detail sometime later, was formed in 1849. And at the time it was formed, you had Ben Franklin, who was very much behind it. In fact, he was involved in actually running it for a period of time. He was a correspondent, or running, he was a corresponding secretary. But within 15 years, he had turned against it. And, you know, this is one man, really one man's view as to why he made this change. And that's David Lipscomb wrote about the fact that he changed. This was after Franklin died. And his view was that Ben Franklin was torn between two great desires. On the one hand, he had a passion for unity among the brethren, and on the other, he had a passion for independent stand for the truth. In the article, he makes the point that Franklin could be persuaded that the, and was persuaded at a period of time we had poor judgment, that the adoption of societies would bring about better unity and activity. And what's interesting, a little bit interesting about this, is prior to this change that he came over him, and while he was still supporting this organization, he spent some time with Tolbert Fanning. And they both agreed at the time that these societies were wrong, that they were unscriptural. And yet, and they agreed they'd resist them, but Franklin still had this drive. He was convinced in his own mind that societies, while unscriptural, he hoped to see that they would have a positive impact on unity, and that he could somehow harmonize their organization and the lack of having a scriptural basis with what they did. And of course, he never reached that. Eventually, he stood against the society. And he would be opposed, as the instrumental issue came up, he would be opposed to that. And that's another one. We'll see how that develops in more detail in later lessons. And I'll be doing that. I mean, as we go through these guys, because they are contemporaries of that period of time, I'll talk to you. You know, you'll see in your lesson they either stood for or against. In some cases, we'll talk about why they stood for or against these changes. Moses Lord was the Tennessean, and the family was in was extremely poor. And they moved off to Missouri when he was 11, and before he was 11. But by the time he was 11, his dad had passed away, and his mother was unable to take care of the children, the six children in the family. And so Moses and his brother, at 11 years old, left town, the house, and went out on their own to work and to live and take the burden off their mother. Well, by the time 6 years later, he had learned to read, but he had not learned to write. And so he taught himself to write by cutting out letters from posters, advertising posters, and sitting down and tracing them. That's how the man learned how to write. They had a limited amount of education, couldn't read and write when he left home. Learned to read, learned to write. He was working as a tailor when he was 17, and a fellow befriended he and his brother, the name of Arthur King, who ran an academy. And so for these two brothers doing work for Arthur King, he agreed to give them room and board and schooling. So they got some formal education at that point in time. In the next few years, he listened to various denominational speakers, heard pleas from the Calvinistic preachers that were telling the people they were preaching to you needed to get an experience. And he is basically turned off by religion altogether. Somewhere a little further down the road, he began to hear of this new preaching that was going on, that was trying to go back to first century gospel and practices of the first century gospel. And so he, in the course of that, came across, you may remember we talked briefly about Scott's Gospel Restored, something that Walter Scott wrote. And he read that, in fact, ate it up, basically. And his eyes were open. In fact, he'd later tell Scott that Scott was responsible for being the man that first taught him the gospel. So he learned what he learned on the basis of follow-on to Walter Scott's writings. Lord was 23 when he first heard the gospel actually being preached by somebody. And as a result of that, he would be baptized. Interestingly enough, this guy was like a lot of these people we've seen. They were Baptists, they were Methodists, they were something. They came out of something and were on the frontier preaching during the Restoration period. It didn't take him long after that. He ended up preaching in Missouri and continued doing his work as a tailor. But he would, that would change with time. And by now, he had a wife, he had two children. He's 27 years old. And, you know, today we know that people go back and get, you know, second degrees and things of that nature. Well, in this day and age, that was very unusual. He didn't have a lot of money. But they made an effort for him to go back to go to a higher, a school of higher learning. In this case, he went to Bethany College, which was actually a religious, taught Bible topics in that college. And he went in 45 at age of 27, and he completed a 4-year work in 3 years. He was valedictorian of his class. And so the guy had skills, as they say. Despite lacking in education, early education, he was a very, very capable individual, evidently. And so he went back to Missouri and started preaching. and preached there for the next 10 or so years. There was a fellow in, just this is a little side trip, a fellow wrote a review or booklet called A Review on Campbellism. This was a Virginia Baptist. And Campbell, this is a point in time in Campbell's life where he was very busy, so he grabbed Lard and asked him if he would respond and write back an article that countered what this person was saying, which Lard did. But the point of that is, Campbell, you know, viewed Lard at this point as a very competent mind and writer, and he delegated that off to him, gave him the requested he do it, and sure enough, Lord did it, and did well, I suppose. Lord started producing something called the Lord's Quarterly, which you can find reference to this. If you ever do any work in this area, you'll find references to this a lot longer. Much longer than after Lard passed from the face of the earth. And this publication did not last very long. It was only a five-year publication. But it was apparently one of the best, richest periodicals for matters that pertain to the Restoration Movement issues of his day. And, you know, dealing with those issues, I say restoration issues, things not only pertaining to the restoration and pertaining to the going back to the Bible, but in dealing with some of the issues that people have digressed into. And so he made strong arguments and had a tremendous influence on people. He closed the quarterly. Again, it was a financial problem. And started working with four others on something called the Apostolic Times. He was one of those that was very strongly opposed to instrumental music, that issues that came on the scene at this point in time. And he found it impossible. He had a strong view on this one, so he found it impossible to cooperate with brethren who were using instruments in their singing. And, you know, would tell everybody else not to as well. In fact, he wrote in his, at one point in time, let every preacher resolve at once he will never enter a meeting house in which an organ stands. Let no brother ever unite with another using an organ. Let brethren remonstrate in gentle, kind, but decided terms, and if unheeded, let them abandon the church. Thus, these organ-grinding churches will be broken down, and the sooner they are in fragments, the better for the cause of Christ. So he was a very outspoken individual in terms of his writings and trying to influence people on what the truth was and on what they needed to do in his view as a result of that. He was also critical of the American Christian Missionary Society, and his logic was one of made, an argument was made on the basis of expediency, saying it was an unnecessary expediency. I would argue, and others will argue, it was not an expediency at all, but in any event, that was his view. And because of his objections to these two things, that's one of the big reasons his quarterly didn't have funds. People withdrew. Remember, these papers were taking the position of brotherhood, quote unquote, papers. And so if you didn't, you know, if you start arguing against what we believed, we'll walk with the purse. And that's okay if you walk with, you know, if you happen to have something you don't think you want to listen to anymore. We do it all the time. You walk with the purse. If this was a broader, you know, it would spread around the quote brotherhood, and they would pull support from it. He lost it. That's one reason. The last year of his life was spent as a president of the College of the Bible. So you got a guy that's come from backwoods through his life, and ends, and that was with very little education, ends up being president of a college. which is, I think, you know, I think it speaks to the quality and people like this. It's impressive to me, anyway. It's impressive. May not be impressive to you. It's to me. Bit of trivia for you. College of the Bible started out as something called Bacon College, after some guy named Bacon. They would change their name to Kentucky University, and then in 1865, they were required to split that out. College of the Bible came out, and something called the College of Agriculture and Mechanical Arts was the other piece. So they separated the religious from the secular. The College of the Bible would turn into the Lexington Theological Seminary. And what do you think the Ag School turned into?
UK.
That's the University of Kentucky. So that's trivia for you. Anything about that, either one of these two guys we talked about? Any questions?
Okay. Well, if you do research on these men, like, you know, against this one about the use of musical instrument, do you ever read about how they justify they were against them and the use? I mean, you ever gotten to that level? How do they, what scriptures and what was the logic to them, right? That, my question is, would they argue it like we would argue it today, or would it be something different?
Somewhat. Yeah, and we'll see some of that as time goes on. Yeah, and that some of them would argue for reasons that I think would not hold water, but others would argue on the basis of scriptural arguments. So it'll, you know, it'll vary. We'll see. I've got some quotes on it. I think I've got them on. Things on there are pretty.
But the great debates hadn't started yet.
Yeah, I'll get them on. I'll give them to you on Crete. You know, if we get that far today, if we want. Some of the things he had, some of his reasoning. Sorry?
The great debates hadn't really started yet.
I don't know what the great debates you're talking about.
Well, Kentucky, even coming down into Texas and everything like that, during the times that the church, the Lord's church split, you know, because of instrumental music, because of missionary society, the papers, and this kind of thing. Had the debate started at this time?
It's underway if we're speaking.
Okay.
And we'll look at the history of how today there are Christian churches and churches of Christ and institutional churches of Christ and non-institutional churches. We'll look a little bit of that if we don't run out of classes.
Well, how did the Civil War affect all these? I mean, you guys' lives all were intertwined with that time period.
Yeah, and it depends. Some of these organizational activities, just like we saw in, I forget which one, Baptist, Southern Baptist, like we saw in that, you'll find that the war question would get in the middle of their organizational issues. A lot of these men are still, some of these men we'll talk about are still involved in various associations. So there's they have their preaching activities, but then there's this association. And the acceptability of certain parts of the country, namely North-South, would come into play in those. And organizations would tend to get caught up in some of the politics. And so it would pack in. Now, individually, as these men go, I can't say to what extent. They pretty much, what I can tell, they pretty much stayed out of, most of them, stayed out of the fray of the war. Didn't get caught up in that as far as starting to preach the North's right or the South's right or any of that, or slavery's okay, slavery's not okay. Probably did, I just didn't get that deep into it. And all of them seemed, the vast majority of them seemed to be active throughout that period and survived, the ones that lived long enough, survived through it and continued to do the work they've been doing.
Was Campbell the only one that preached that Christians should not go to war? or was there others that did that?
There probably were. Campbell was a pacifist. He got there. I'll make some comments about that when we get to another point in my life. I keep telling you, I'm going to keep promising all these promises. Y'all getting ahead of me. Yeah, but he was a pacifist. And I may have some, I don't recall, there may be others that were explicit that way. Okay. Creed. I think I said at one time, I mentioned in this class, Joseph Creed Jr. and made the comment about, Jacob Creed Jr. made the comment, his dad, Jacob Creed Sr., wipe that out of your head, because that's not true, and I'll explain why. William Creed was a Baptist preacher, and actually Jacob Creed Jr. was the son of William Creed. William Creed married, and his wife gave birth to 16 children. William was away most of the time preaching, so it was on the shoulders of mama to raise the children. And she was devout and required the children to read the Bible and commit large portions of it to memory. As it turned out, 5 of her 9 sons ended up being preachers. So she had a tremendous impact on her children, as evidenced in that. Her home was open. Reportedly, preachers from Maine to Georgia would end up coming through, and they'd stay in Creed's home. These were the Baptist preachers. That's what they were. This was the exposure that Jacob Creed Jr. would have. Jacob Creed Jr. was actually, dad, William, said, for whatever reason, let his brother, Jacob Sr., name his son. And Jacob Sr. said, okay, brother, I'm going to call him Jacob Creed Jr. And so he's actually named after his uncle, which seems strange to me.
You got 9 boys, you got to figure out a name somehow.
I guess. he was, of course, being a Baptist preacher, dad being a Baptist preacher, Jacob was exposed to Baptist doctrine, Calvinistic doctrine, and throughout that time, of course, he heard that something had to happen to him. He had to have some kind of experience to be saved. And he could not get the experience. So he became very frustrated. You know, even when he thought he had a little emotional tinge about him, it went away and he just didn't feel right. And for a while he turned his back on religion. But that didn't last very long. At a Baptist meeting in the Maharon Association, responded to the so-called altar call and went forward. And at that, did he have an experience? No. He did it, and they prayed over him, and they declared him saved. And after they declared him saved, later on, he went home, and later on his dad would baptize him. And his reaction to that, and this is how people can be influenced by their emotions, is that this Jacob Creed Jr. Basically commented that he had a measure of peace when he came up out of the water. So it had an emotional impact on him for sure. He became shortly thereafter an ordained minister in the Baptist Church, and he preached in Kentucky, throughout Kentucky, Mississippi, Louisiana, and Tennessee. And he was preaching as a Baptist preacher, preaching Baptist doctrine. He read the Christian Baptist in the course of time and was aware of restoration principles, so that caused him, through his study, to denounce creeds and to change actually what he taught. He taught the Word of God as opposed to Baptist creeds. And as opposed to Calvinistic doctrine, and as a as a result of that, and it's predictable, he was, quote, put on trial by the church where he was preaching, this Great Crossings Church in Kentucky. And so he was, as a result of that, he would ultimately be expelled from that group. He wasn't alone. His uncle, Jacob Creed Sr., was in that same group, as was our old friend Raccoon Smith. And so all three of them were kicked out of the Baptist Association. That was, you know, at that point in time in his career, it was not a big event because he basically left that doctrine some time previous to this, and been preaching the Word of God as opposed to the Baptist Calvinistic doctrine. He would go on to be married and marry a widow, and would move. And shortly after he married, that lady died, and it wasn't long after that, within a year, he was married again, this time again to a widow that I guess would stay with him till his, I don't know if she outlived him, but close to it. He would, during the period of time that he was still in Kentucky, he would work during the week, supporting himself, and then he would pretty much preach on Saturdays and Sundays is the way he carried on. He ran into a guy, or he became friends with a guy by the name of Johnson, and they were just kind of continually together and doing work together. And so they found themselves out preaching together one time in Versailles. Ended up baptizing 140 people in that meeting, and for the next 3 years they just kept preaching continuously until the denominations apparently became alarmed for fear the whole country was going to the Campbellites. So the pair of them in that territory was having a pretty substantial effect on people. While he was in, when he moved to Palmyra, Missouri, he used that as his base, and he ended up preaching through Illinois, Missouri, Louisiana, Kentucky, Indiana, Tennessee. So he had a pretty broad. These guys were circuit preachers. You know, you heard the term circuit preachers? They were circuit preachers. They would go out and be gone for weeks or months on end preaching. Let me see if I can get through with his American Christian Society. He was pretty much bitterly opposed to the ACMS. And one of the arguments that Campbell had made in supporting ACMS was that they had not been. I want y'all to listen to his logic. This is 2016 logic. It's not either. We'll cover.